Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon. I want to welcome you to today's broadcast of the American College Experience. My name is Jason Heath. I am the host of this program, and I am also the Chief Executive Officer of the UR Tennis Network. If this is your first time to listen to us on the UR Tennis Network, congratulations. You have found what we consider to be the best-kept secret in all of tennis, and it's not going to last much longer. We continue to grow every week, and that's thanks to you, the listeners. And we're so excited that you have tuned in today. We want to make sure that we put on a good performance today and that you will tell one of your friends, one of your tennis friends out there today that next week they need to listen to one of our broadcasts. And so excited today. On today's program, we have Coach Ralph Platts. Ralph is one of the Canadian national coaches. He's the former coach of Jeannie Bouchard, and we're going to talk Canadian tennis, its influence on American collegiate tennis, and just his perspective as an international, looking in on this country's professional system and collegiate system, and get some valuable opinions on this. In the meantime, I want to remind you that on Monday morning, we have Parenting Aces with host Lisa Goodman-Stone. Lisa is out of Atlanta, Georgia. She covers all things with junior tennis. We also have a Wednesday, we have American Tennis with Coach Chuck Creasy broadcasting out of the Citadel there in South Carolina. And he deals with the issues involved with American tennis. And then you have me. And I come on and I talk about all things related to college tennis, good and bad. And as many of you know, there have been many interesting things that have happened to college tennis since I have been on the air. And we try to bring those forth to you each week. I try to cover all the divisions. Being a former junior college coach myself of 20 years, I like to share my opinion about college tennis. I was a bottom dweller in the JC division, but sent my kids to all the programs that were out there, Division 1, 2, 3, NAIA, and now I've been doing this now for three. This is going on our fourth year. We're approaching 1,400 hours worth of broadcast time here on the UR Tennis Network. We are a compliment to the Tennis Channel, to ESPN, CBS, and anyone else out there that considers tennis a great enough sport to give it some TV time. We consider it a great enough sport to devote 3 hours to the tennis stories that you're not going to hear about on a regular basis, but the personalities that need to be heard from in regards to this tennis business and the sport that these people love and give their hearts to. And we are in that business of telling these great stories. And then the other thing that's happening here on the network is we are over 300,000 downloads to our podcasts, and I couldn't tell you how many live listeners we've had, but we are so thankful to all of you listeners out there and for what you're doing for us, and hope that you will, as I said, pass us along through word of mouth. That is the way that we operate. We don't advertise on air. This is a volunteer network. Our hosts, our guests, passionate about the sport, and we do our best to give it a voice. And so excited that you have come on board today. And first and foremost, let's get to this. If you've been under a rock regarding college tennis, I mean, Chuck and Lisa covered this pretty heavy starting in August. We had the Division I men's and women's NCAA championship cabinet. They had a proposal that recommended several changes to Division I men's and women's tennis scoring. And it was all aimed at reducing the length of matches. As many of you know, there is no current effort to reduce college football's time on TV, no effort to reduce college basketball's time on TV. But for some reason, the NCAA thought it was wise to go after college tennis. And we're not quite sure, but we're investigating where this came from and who was responsible for it. What we think that we're aware of here is that there was a large petition put out by the NCAA Division I women's coaches, and they listened. And these coaches, and then we also know that Coach Chuck Creasy and his conference, the American Conference, that they were going to boycott this, not to mention the other smaller conferences that we did not verbally hear from, but we knew that if you were not going to be on TV, there really was no point in accepting a scoring change that was being mandated or forced upon you. And a good friend of mine, J.P. Weber, loves that word, mandate, and we are going to use it today. These smaller Division I programs that love to play tennis, they don't necessarily stop when the first team reaches four. They like their doubles. They may even play eight-game pro sets behind the backs of the NCAA and ITA and USTA. And they may even let the fans that come out see an actual full tennis match go to completion with two out of three sets, tiebreakers, that sort of thing. And we hope that in this case we see more rebelling of this nature, because that's the way tennis should be. When a parent comes to watch their child play, they should get to watch them play. They shouldn't be engulfed in a match and have it cut short. That's not tennis. Tennis, we start, we finish, and we try to complete. And this was just contradictory to what is inside our hearts and what is available to us as far as a scoring system goes. I can remember being at a set Division I college match in the spring and being so disappointed that the team stopped when it was four. And I couldn't imagine being a parent traveling and like I said, not getting to watch your son complete the second set in the singles because Joe Bag of Donuts had clinched the fourth point down there, and you traveling, paying a flight cross country to watch your son play and only getting to watch him play what amounted to about 50 minutes of tennis. So thank goodness for that. This happened on September 11th. The cabinet met in Indianapolis. They referred the proposal back to Division I men's and women's, the tennis committee, and asked them to gather feedback from the sports student athletes. And we already know, based on the 8,000 signatures that are out there on a Facebook page, that this has been protested, and these people on this committee just did not listen. The cabinet members also suggested another survey be sent to the membership, and then it originate from the tennis committee. And this is an interesting move here. I don't know if the ITA and the USTA are going to be for this. The coach from Gonzaga, DJ Garul, who's a former chairperson of this committee, said that this was his quote: "We put a lot of time and effort into this, so we're disappointed. But we know we've got to reengage with the entire tennis community of coaches and student athletes to come up with a model that is in the best interest of the sport and is more broadly supported. And let me just say to you, Coach Gruhle, that, and I've learned this myself, that you have an opportunity to do it the right way at times. And as human beings, at times we forget that maybe there is a right way to do it. It takes time and effort, and perhaps that we need to slow down here. And I know through past experiences that I have rushed through things, done things my own way, and not considered others, and then end up not getting exactly as I thought I wanted, and being upset about it, whereas if I had just approached it the right way the first time, maybe things would have gone a little bit smoother. You should definitely include the players who do play this sport and the coaches and the other members of your sport when you're deciding to make a change. As I mentioned, football and basketball, they're not shortening their fields. They're not shortening the goals. It's funny to me. I mean, who would actually watch American football if you actually scored it properly? Think about it like this. We give 6 points for a touchdown when it's only really worth 1 point. So imagine your college football teams, instead of the scores being, 70-3, what if it were just 1-1? I mean, who would really watch football? I mean, who would really get excited about it if they actually told the truth in regards to their score? Basketball, they have a 3-point shot. We all know in sports, it really isn't a thing as a 3-point shot. I mean, in tennis, we don't have a 3-point shot. We battle 1 point at a time. And that's what makes us unique. We don't have a clock. We just go out there and we do battle until the score says we're finished. And perhaps maybe the other sports should consider what tennis is doing instead of us considering what the other sports are doing. As far as I know, and feel free to call in and correct me in this, but in ancient Rome, they built a huge Colosseum to watch two gladiators do battle on a weekend. Very popular back in the day. And now, tennis being the sport it is, when you watch the results of the populations that went to the U.S. Open, there are still hundreds of thousands of people that at one given time love to watch two people do battle. And that's maybe where we need to learn from. I just don't think there are enough tennis people in the media industry. I don't think there are enough people in the sports industry that know how to tell a tennis story, and hopefully that'll work. As a reminder, what they were trying to do here, no ad scoring in singles and doubles, three doubles matches played with each match consisting of one set to six games with a tiebreaker at six games all. After a 10-minute intermission, the six singles matches would begin, and each match played in a best-of-three set format and tiebreakers at six games all. No warm-up with the opponents, which is just one of those rules that you're just like, what does that matter? Is it really going to cut back on the time for this? I mean, we've got commercial time in these TV matches anyway, so you can't let the kids warm up with each other while you're out there promoting some sugary drink or, whatever it is that you think is going to help tennis. I'm baffled by this. So I'm excited that I'd like to think that we had an influence. I know we did. I mean, Chuck battled this thing, and I know that he talked to his people. I know Lisa was out there talking as well, and it's exciting to see that now 2 years, two big events in college tennis, and we've had some influence in that, and hopefully we can influence other areas as well, because this is something that people always told us we weren't going to be able to do, and that was talk tennis in a civilized manner and get the issues worked out. So it's an interesting time. Now I'm going to I've got Coach Platts here on the air. I'm gonna introduce him, but I think I'm gonna try to call him after we introduce him. So let me Let me see here if that's the case, because I know in Canada, those Canadian phone companies, you know, their charge is a little bit different. So we're going to see if we can help him out. So hang on just a second. Hold on. Hey, Coach Platts, are you there? He did disappear. So let me see that I've got his number right before I call. And, yep, I'll be calling him right now. So hang on just for a second here, people. I don't do this often, so just bear with me as we go through this. 514.
Strauss.
Coach Platts.
Jason Haynes, how are you?
I'm fine today. How are you?
Yeah, I'm real good, real good. It's a sunny day, a little bit cool, but it's still okay for outdoor tennis.
I would believe so. Now, are you in Montreal, or where are you at today?
I'm in Montreal, right here at the National Training Center in Montreal, yeah.
Yeah, very good. You know, as we go through the interview today, and I say this to my guests each week, they're going to be people that have no idea who you are. So if you will, take a moment and biographically introduce yourself and how you got to where you are today, Val.
Okay, well, I'll try to make short work of it. It shouldn't be too much trouble making short work of that. I grew up in Canada playing tennis. My grandfather actually owned a tennis club when I was a kid, and so that obviously helped in my decision to play lots of tennis. And, you know, my family was involved with the association and stuff, but I played at a fairly high national level in Canada, and played some international events and stuff. I went on to play college tennis at Northern Illinois University, where I had a interesting experience, shall we say. I had three different coaches over my four-year period there, and was recruited by Carl Neufeld, who I believe is at SMU now. After I graduated college, I had aspirations of playing some tennis, and I actually started working in Chicago and wanting to play at the same time, and I kind of was in the right place at the right time, and I met up with Helena Sukova at the Virginia Slims event, and she hired me to be her hitting partner / coach advisor, if you will, at the time, and I stayed with her for quite a few months and traveled with her a bit, and from there went on to coach some Japanese girls, three Japanese girls who had some pretty good results, semifinalists of Junior Wimbledon, and Sohori Obata, she had a pretty good career in the pros, getting to be about, I think she was top 50 or something. And I worked, was fortunate to work quite a bit with Laura Granville in Chicago. I worked for one of her coaches, John Trump, who was a very good mentor to me in Chicago. And so I was fortunate to spend quite a bit of time on court with Laura Granville and help to develop her game as a junior into the pros. And that pretty much brought me back to Canada, and Tennis Canada picked me up and hired me to be one of the national coaches at the National Training Center in Montreal, where I've, in the past, I've been here 6 years now, and worked with Eugenie Bouchard when she was 16 for the year, and had Francoise Abanda for a couple of years, who... obviously, Eugenie, I think people know who she is nowadays. Francoise Abanda just qualified for the U.S. Open main draw and lost first round, but she's only 17, so I think that's a decent result. And I currently am spending the majority of my time with a young girl named Charlotte Robillard-Miette, who is our current Canadian national champion, and she's progressing quite well. Just got her first pro ranking a couple weeks ago. She's ranked about in the 800s in pros now, and we're looking to get her into the Grand Slam juniors in the next quarter, we'll say, for junior results. And
Go ahead.
I also work with another girl, Rosie Johansson, who is another up-and-comer junior in Canada. So, and that brings us to right now.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to have you on the show. We you are very valuable to our neighbors in the north, the Canadians. You have been doing a lot of homework for Canadian tennis. You have are well traveled. You have been in the American collegiate system, and in my opinion, you're going to have a wealth of information in regards to an international's perspective on what's happening here as a professional and as a collegiate watcher here. Through the years, Canada has sent many great college tennis players across the border, Ralph. Kind of help me understand how that process works within Tennis Canada. Do you identify these youngsters early on, or is it a choice for them? How does it work over, or should I say up there?
Well, yeah, I guess it is up there. Well, I mean, first and foremost, our mandate here at the National Tennis Center is not to create college players. And, you know, our mandate, I basically am getting paid by trying to create professional tennis players. That being said, you know, if a player at the age of 18 or you know, sometimes 17, because the school system, at least in Quebec, is a little bit different than the rest of Canada and the rest of North America, they can go to college at 17. But if they're not ready to make a living in the pros, then, you know, we've always viewed college tennis as a viable option and tried to use that as a stepping stone to the pros. Obviously, I work a little bit more on the girls' side. I don't know how that started, but I work fully on the girls' side now. And unfortunately, in most cases, it's not necessarily a viable option for using college tennis as a stepping stone to the pros at this point in time. I certainly hope that changes. I mentioned while I was giving sort of a biography of myself, after I worked with Françoise Abanda for a number of years, I also worked with Carol Zhao and Aaron Routliff, who I sent both to college last year. And Aaron Routliff won NCAAs in doubles last year as a freshman, and Carol Zhao, she goes to Stanford, and I think she was All-American in singles and doubles last year. So, you know, basically the players are picked, we'll say, at age 13 to 14 to start coming to the National Center and being here full-time, and we're trying to groom them for the pros that way.
Now, are you looking all over Canada for these 13, 14-year-olds to come in? Do you find the late bloomer every once in a while? How is that process, till the age of 13, 14?
Well, that's it. I mean, there's talent identification camps for the ages all the way down to 8 and 9 that we've developed over the last number of years. You know, obviously, we're trying to require our players to play in the Canadian National Championships, and so that kind of groups all of the players together and gives a lot of the national coaches, gives them a look at the players all in one place. But yeah, all across the country, we're looking for the talent, and we're trying to build tennis, trying to build more players, and obviously trying to get better players out of the more players.
Well, I think based on your international experience and your success on the women's side here, that Tennis Canada has made a great decision here. You've seen many international students be successful out on the tour with Tsukuba and in the Japanese girls, Laura Granville, Jeannie. Are there certain things that you can identify in them, each one of them, that maybe were the same that allowed them to succeed at the professional level that the college players don't have?
Well, that's an interesting question. And we'll say, I mean, each and every player has been different. And you know, I came into Skova's life when she was already a seasoned pro. And, you know, that was towards the end of her career. But it was interesting to watch her attitudes and her beliefs and you know, how she held herself. And the Japanese girls were very different, I believe, because of the culture that they grew up in. And, you know, they were kind of the model students, if you will, because you tell them to jump and in Japanese they would say, how high? And interesting, it was it's a good question with Jeannie, because for Jeannie at a very early age, I think I've known her since she's 10, and at a very early age, we'll say 11 or 12, she knew she was going to be a professional player. And it, also her family knew she was going to be a professional player. So there was never a college option that even entered their minds. And in fact, I think she was signed by an agent by the age of 14. And so that that option went out the window anyhow. But it was never an option. It was either I'm going to be pro or that's it.
So I'm curious, how many female athletes within the Canadian system currently that you see, or how many do you see on a regular basis, I guess, would be, you know, I mean, do you see them every day? Do they come in on a weekend type basis? What is the program like?
Well, basically, I'm personally responsible for just two athletes right now. And it doesn't mean I don't work with the other athletes, but I'm responsible for their schedules. I'm responsible for making sure they're getting the right fitness and making sure they're getting enough court time and basically developing them as tennis players. And so I work with these girls 4 to 5 hours a day, and they're in school the rest of the time. The other girls who are at the center have a coach similar to me, and the other coaches are responsible for the other girls.
Now, one of the big things that happens here in the U.S., we seem to think that our professional players need to be homeschooled or a school of a different nature. Do the Canadian kids go through a public school, or are they homeschooled? What's the philosophy there?
Well, I mean, it's our players at the National Center here, they are basically in a school, like long distance learning, I think it's called. And we also have a school teacher here at the National Center who is in charge of making sure their schooling needs are getting taken care of. And basically in the 7 years that this National Training Center has been open, there's only been one case, I believe, of the players not completing their high school. So I think we've got a pretty good track record in that department too. And but, I mean, when you're looking internationally at all of the players who are playing, competing, and training so much, I think it's very difficult to go to a normal school. And, you know, everyone, if you're on the junior ITF tour, will say, I highly doubt any of the players in the top 200 in the junior ITF are attending normal school anywhere in the world. And so I think just to keep up with that, I think, yeah, it is necessary to have some kind of a internet school or long-distance learning or something that's going to allow you to put in the appropriate amount of time, 4 or 5 hours a day, to get the necessary training requirements.
Do the Canadians mix their practices? Do the top junior girls work with the top junior boys, as we see at some of the colleges here in America, where these coaches have two teams and they put them together? Is that a philosophy that's carried with you up there, or do you individually just say, okay, we're just going to work girls and the boys are going to take care of themselves?
It's pretty much separated as far as practice goes, boys and girls. Now, that doesn't mean I try to pick up a boy here and there to be a hitting partner, but no, practices are not held together, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And for that matter, I like the girls to compete against one another if we're doing practice sets or that kind of stuff, but often, you know, if we're in a training block of 3 weeks and you're practicing with the same two or three girls over and over again, it can get pretty dull.
Sure. 4 to 5 hours a day practicing with these young up-and-coming pros. Ralph, how many hours on court versus conditioning and other things?
Well, Jason, it depends on the time of year, really. And if the periodization is done adequately, then I believe sometimes they'll be in the gym and doing fitness up to 3 hours a day and tennis for maybe an hour a day. And that can completely reverse when we're getting into a competitive phase. Getting closer to tournament time, then it'll be more tennis and less fitness, and then tapering down the tennis right before tournament time. So, I mean, it varies according to what time of year it is.
Now, you mentioned that it is a nice day in Montreal. How much longer do you have nice outdoor days before you have to make a change in that season?
Well, that's another good question. I had a meeting with Charlotte's parents yesterday, and they were praising me for making the girls play outside even when it was relatively chilly. So the weather is really changing here now. All the leaves are turning, and today we practiced, and it was about 9 degrees Celsius outside. I think that's about getting close to 50 Fahrenheit or 45 Fahrenheit. Yeah. So it was a little bit chilly, but you know what? We're trying to develop tough tennis players here. So if it's 9 degrees, that means we just got to keep working.
Yeah. And your summer experience as you went through it, it was a successful summer for Tennis Canada by your standards. You guys were... American standards, you're blowing us out of the water. I mean, by your standards, though, how did you do?
For both of my players, Charlotte had a fantastic last 3 months and really progressed well. For the pro players, obviously, Jeannie's had an incredible year, and, you know, sometimes the expectations get mismanaged, and you know she had a couple bad tournaments, including her home tournament at Rogers Cup, and I don't think her U.S. Open was as good as she expected or people's expectations were of her, but you know it was still pretty good, and obviously Milos had a great year and just won against Colombian Davis Cup over the weekend, and so I think the year was a positive year. And, you know, we at Tennis Canada who are working on all this stuff, you know, we know there's still a long ways to go. And we've got a few players in the top 10 in the world now, and that was always a goal. But there's other goals that we have as well, and we've got to try and fulfill those ones.
For sure. You have been very successful with the young ladies that you put into the American college system. The University of Alabama, we've had Coach Mines on the air. Stanford University is one of the top tennis and academic universities in the United States. You're not sending players to, and I don't mean anything negative by it, but these directional schools, your kids are going, the ones that you work with are top-notch players here, Ralph.
Well, that's it. And, I with Aaron Routliff, who plays for Jenny Mains. She and Jenny does a fantastic job. I think she's an incredible coach. I have some expectations for those players to bounce out of college and play at a decent professional level. And it really it scares me sometimes because I'm not convinced that they're getting the preparation while in college that they're going to need to survive on the pro tour. I work very hard at my job and I put out a lot of sweat, and there's a lot of sweat equity, if you will, that goes into what I do. And you know, it really is satisfying to see girls like Eugenie Bouchard to go on and be top 10 in the world. And even some of those college players, I think that there's potential for them to have a real successful college career. And they're already having a successful college career. I think they can have a successful professional career. And I hope that they're getting the necessary preparation while they're in college to succeed at the pro level.
You know, Ralph, what we know in my experience here on the show and researching a lot is that there aren't a lot of professional women's tennis players that come out of the college system. I mean, there are some success stories. And you know, I speak frankly with you in this and truthfully as I can. I'm not quite sure that the system, you know, in the long run, with its 25 dates, its watch practices, and other things, is set up well to for a professional male or female to bust out in this arena. So your young ladies that participated in this first second year of college tennis, are they coming back home to work with you after the summer, or do you see them?
Well, that's a great question, and I agree with you 100%. And it's tough in college because number one and first and foremost, the players, male or female, they've got to have good grades, and you know, their GPAs have to be up to par, and so they've got to put the time in with the books. So that's number one, and that's a given, and. What I worry about is that I think it's a different animal with the guys and with the girls. And, you know, Jason, you put you and I on a tennis court, and you and I are probably, chances are good, you and I are going to compete very hard against one another, even if we don't have a coach on the court with us. And we're going to try to beat each other, and we're going to push each other. And, you know, that could be a positive training environment. But I don't know that girls specifically are doing the same things with one another. And so if they have a total of 20 months off over a four-year period, so let's say the majority of the college kids are they've got between mid-May and mid-September off or thereabouts, so we'll say about 5 months. And if they've got 5 months off, for 4 years, that's 20 months. Well, that's almost 2 years. That's almost 2 years of no coaching. And, you know, a lot of these girls and are a lot of the students, they have internships by their third year and fourth year. And so they're not training the way that they need to be training. And now what I will say is, yes, for example, Carol Zhao, who had a decent year at Stanford this year, I think the minute she was done her final exam, she was practicing and she was back at the National Center. And yes, we invited her to come back and we gave her access to a coach, and she had a full tournament schedule for the summer. And her ranking right now is top 300. So she's had a pretty good summer. She's done a great job. But I don't know that all of the girls, whether they're Canadian or American or European or whatever, are doing the same thing. But I do think that that's a necessary thing.
You know, that's definitely an interesting way to put it, Ralph. I mean, we know right now, I mean, given the current situation right now as of September, that these college coaches, these Division I sports, they're in full season. They are hitting the courts as many hours as they can. These coaches are giving private lessons in the course of the week. On the weekends, they are traveling and playing. So now, not necessarily the time to be concerned, but as one of the top Canadian coaches, if not the top on the women's side, that's not the concern of yours. Your concern is what happens here in a few weeks when nothing's going on.
That's right. And you know, the new changes and scoring formats and all this kind of stuff, I just don't see how it can help. Often the matches are, matches are being called, and there's still one match going on. but it becomes meaningless, so it stops being played. And, you know, if that happens three or four times per season, then you're losing out on four matches. And, you know, if through studies and research of my own, on average, I think that at a time when you're 17, 18 years old, then I think that you need to have between 50 and 75 good quality matches per year, with a decent win-loss ratio there.
Absolutely. But college tennis, it should be about building confidence. I mean, we know that professional tennis, you have to prepare yourself basically to lose once a week. We'd like to think that you can win every week, you know, four or five rounds and make it to the final. Federer was good at it for the longest time, but he's the exception to the rule. You have to prepare yourself to lose. In college tennis, that's not the case most of the time, and with these exceptional players.
That's right. And, you know, the fact is that we all hope that college tennis can be a viable stepping stone to the pros, because, I mean, I have a 5-year-old daughter, and I would really like to think that if she's not a professional player by the time she's 17, that she can still get a great education and still give a good shot at in the pros afterwards. But, you know, it does worry me with the changes going on, and it worries me that they're not getting the necessary coaching over the summers and not getting the necessary match plays during season. And I think the practices and things like that, the amount of time on court during their season and their practice season, I think that's pretty good. And you know, there's some awfully, awfully good coaches in the college system. That's for sure also.
Exactly. And we're discovering that a lot of these college coaches have the ability to take, you know, large groups of players. I interviewed Chris Garner from the Naval Academy a couple of weeks ago. He had 22 guys on his team, able to maneuver this team through a season and develop national champions out of this. This is a great feeling for an individual to be on a team and to succeed, you know, in that arena. Unfortunately, only 5 teams per year get that designation with each division. And so there are a lot of people out there that can come away from a college tennis season feeling disappointed on the team side. We know that the NCAA at the Division I side has created an individual tournament, which allows that one particular person to feel great about themselves. But it's a weird format. I mean, take the young lady that played either at Alabama or Stanford, these girls are involved with the team championship, which is held the week prior, and then they get into an individual. And you know, as Jenny put it, these kids, as they grow through college tennis, become more and more interested in their team and not letting their teammates down, rather than being an individual in this sport. That itself is a different mentality as a pro player, correct, Ralph?
Well, for sure. And you know, you hear Eugenie Bouchard say that she has no friends on the tour, and she's out there by herself and with her team, so to speak, and she's trying to win matches and win tournaments and make a great living. But, you know, there's something to be said for playing for your team, and you know, that probably can develop you in a pretty positive way as a person. And, you know, that's definitely a plus. But, I mean, if we're talking business, then, you know, you're not playing for anybody else but yourself when you're out on the tour.
Yeah. And your player from the University of Alabama, she was one of those individuals that was able to capture one of those individuals titles, the doubles championship. This is quite an honor. You said she was a freshman. Is that right, Ralph?
That's right. And she's an exceptionally talented athlete. And it's a pretty good result to win NCAAs as a freshman. I know there's been a few do it. Mallory Cecil won it as a freshman and won, I think, singles. And there's been quite a few others who are winning it as freshmen. Nicole Gibbs, I think she's having a pretty good career right now playing pros, but she's only been out on the tour for a couple of years, and I think she's about 100 in the world now. But as you
alluded to earlier on, that there are lots of examples, but it's definitely not the trend.
Well, Ralph, I mean, it's the consistent example, I think, that we need to search for. I mean, if your young lady, hypothetically, let's just say here, goes through this year and she wins another one or two big NCAA titles on the single side of things, and she complements her doubles title, then that will improve upon her confidence as she battles amongst these Division I players. Don't you agree?
Yeah, absolutely agreed. And then it comes down to the individual, and you have to kind of ask them what they want. What do you want out of your tennis life? And so if you've achieved all the goals that you can achieve in college tennis, then obviously the next step is to move on. But I don't see 80 girls coming out of college tennis per year finishing their eligibility and making a living on the tour.
Yes, sir. That is indeed a true fact there. Ralph, a lot of my college coaching friends here at the Division I level, they encourage their athletes to play not only collegiately, but the USTA, the futures, satellites and things like that. Are your players, Zhao and the young lady from Alabama, are they encouraged to do the same thing?
Yes. In fact, Carol Zhao, who, again, is a wonderful girl and a very talented athlete, she played CeCe Bellis in a 75,000 in Albuquerque 2 days ago. And so she hasn't quite, I guess she's in her first week of school, or maybe they start next week. But she's had a full ITF schedule, played a lot of 25s, she got the wild card at the Stanford tournament and in the qualifying and got through to main draw, which was pretty good. And I think she lost in the next round after CeCe Bellis, but I think her deal is that she's going to play 5 or 6 events per year during the school year, and then obviously in the summer she can set up her schedule however she wants. So I think that's a big plus. And I remember I was in Brazil for the Banana Bowl and the Girdle Cup, and there was I call him Coach Carlos. I can't think of his last name. He's the coach at Kentucky for the women's team right now, super guy. And he was there recruiting. And I was thinking to myself, and as I was talking to him, I'm wondering, why are you in Brazil recruiting right now? Because the girls in this tournament, we're going to say 75% of them are just going to go straight onto the tour, because, these are probably the top 50 girls in the world in the ITF juniors. And most of them are from South America or from Europe, and they're probably not going to play college tennis. I'm wondering why you're recruiting here. And so we got on to talking, and I remember suggesting to him that he has to sell the college programs as a place where he can develop players so that they can go on to the tour. And one good way to do that is work out a deal where they can play 5 or 6 tournaments per year, professional tournaments, whether they be 10,000s or 25,000s, or if their ranking's good enough to play higher than that, and market the program or sell the program that way, and that way he could get better players into his stream. And I see most of the college coaches doing that exact thing right now. I'm sure it wasn't my brilliant idea in the first place, but I think that's a definite positive move for the college coaches to allow them to play these professional events.
That's interesting. Now, these girls come home December, January. Do they look up Coach Ralph and say, "Hey, let's get outside and get inside and work out"?
Well, some of them do and some of them don't. Some of them, they go home to their parents, and that's a tough time of year, obviously because of the holidays, but, uh,
you know, that's Coach Ralph is on holidays at that time of year too, and tradition has dictated that he's already been on tour for 4 or 5 weeks straight during the months of November and December, and so he wants to take a little break before the Australian Open starts, and so it's a tough time of year to do that. Now, that being said, players like Carol Zhao, who we're going to say have a decent professional ranking already, they're already players in our country, they do get invited to take part in the Fed Cup training camp. So, you know, that's another way for them to some quality training. So, you know, we try to include the players who are at the appropriate levels into things like that.
That's outstanding. One of my good friends, Chuck Creasy, he's mentioned before that the system needs to be set up to where you can launch a collegiate tennis player after the NCAA championships into the summer for individual competition. Would you agree with that, that with the college schedule, you being a player, former player, now a coach of some of these top-notch American collegiate players, that with a little tweak here and there that we could actually enhance that spring schedule and use it as somewhat of a ramp to propel these top college players into the professional realms?
Absolutely. I listened to your show when Coach Creasy was on, and you know, I don't know him personally. I know his name for years and years, but he seems to me to be quite a brilliant man. And I think that's exactly the evolution that needs to be taken with college tennis. And I believe that maybe college tennis has declined in producing professional players because of the evolution of the rest of the world. For example, China, you know, China, again, I'm talking on the women's side, but China's, I think they've got 6 or 7 women in the top 50 now, or very close to that. But, you know, none of those Chinese are coming to play college tennis. But if the U.S. did something to promote their top players anyhow, like we're going to say the top 20 schools, do something to promote them into a professional schedule in the spring and summer, I mean, that's going to make a big difference in the way things are working at this point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm having trouble here as I travel through this, Ralph, it just doesn't seem like there's a great deal of consideration and cooperation amongst the governing bodies in how to propel these athletes out there. I mean, when you look at the NCAA football program, this last year alone, we launched 256 collegiate players into the NFL for training, and some of them are now playing on TV on Sunday. The same with the NCAA basketball. We're going to put 100 kids into the draft, and they're going to go through their respective programs. When you take college tennis, we just do not turn out the players into the professional ranks, and nobody says, hey, let's enhance the program.
Well, the difference, obviously the program needs to be enhanced. That's it's a no-brainer. It's a no question. But the difference is that the Chinese don't have a professional football team competing against the Dallas Cowboys on Sundays. And you know, Brazil doesn't have a professional football team, you know, on Monday Night Football, and, you know, the rest of the countries. And let's be honest here, tennis is a great, great, great sport. We all love it. We're all passionate about it. But it's because of the whole international realm. And, you know, the U.S. and Canada, we're competing against the rest of the world. And we can say that, you know, amazing guys like John McEnroe, who played college tennis and then went on to be top 10 in the world. Well, the international presence was not the same in the late 70s and 80s as it is today.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't mean that we can't find a way to make it better.
I agree. I'm befuddled by this because it there are a lot of people that look at this, you know, from the outside and see distinct ways in which you could enhance this program. And yet internally, people seem to have a different set of eyes. And I'm wondering, you know, why is it so hard to be on the inside looking out?
Well, I mean, do the athletic directors really care about the developing professional tennis players? I'm not sure. Maybe they are, but I'm not sure. I'm sure they care about their team winning. And, you know, that's another one of my biases towards college tennis. And I mean, I don't want to sound like an anti-college tennis person, because I'm certainly not. I had a great experience
right.
myself, and I think it's a fabulous thing. It's a great system. But, you know, what happens, how can you develop a player when you're only concerned about winning? And if a coach in a college program is not winning, then he probably is going to lose his job. And so
yeah.
there's a lot of different ways to win in tennis, which are not necessarily developing your game.
Well, Ralph, one of the things that I enjoyed in my time at Lee College, at the community college level there, was when my young ladies transferred to Division I, II, III schools, whichever it was, when you looked them up on the roster later on after their 2 years there, on each of the roster slots, it would list their hometown, have a slash, and then it would list the college that they had transferred from. Now, And let's use your analogy here. And let's just go with Jeannie. If Jeannie had a slash beside her name that said the University of Texas, and she was as successful as she is right now and drew as much attention as she does right now, don't you think that those college athletic directors would be interested in tennis a little bit more?
Absolutely. Absolutely, and you know, Jeannie's doing a lot for tennis in Canada right now for that very same reason, is that, you know, I can't comment on the whole country as a whole because, you know, I'm not all over the country, but I see all of the tennis programs very, very full, especially in the Montreal area. And, you know, we can say that there's a lot of different reasons for that, but certainly one of them is the popularity of Eugenie Bouchard. And, you know, people, those young kids, they want to be like her. So, you know, yes, if she was a college player, and we can even go back a few years to Laura Granville, who won NCAAs twice, or Lisa Raymond, who I believe won four times, you know, college tennis in the 90s, it was probably a little bit more vibrant because they're producing the pros. And, yeah, that's going to pique everybody's interest for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you take Serena Williams, and she graduates from UCLA, and put her against Victoria Azarenka, who went to the University of Florida. Those athletic directors are going to have to start taking notice and saying, my gosh, we're getting a lot more attention here for women's tennis than I ever thought we could.
Yeah, for sure. That's certainly a way to look at it.
Now Ralph, and we're going to wind, and we may lose some of our live listeners here as we finish up this interview. I got to ask, you know, one of the things that bugs a lot of our American tennis participants is, you know, why don't these international countries pursue college tennis in their own university system? So maybe you can help us understand in Canada, why doesn't that happen?
Yeah. Now you're saying developing a similar program in our own country, is that it?
Yeah. Like you had a University of Montreal, and it played the University of Toronto, where you had your own sports teams. We noticed that a lot of the universities outside of the U.S., they just don't pursue college athletics in that regard. So can you help my listeners understand, I mean, in your opinion, why doesn't that happen more often?
Well, I can't speak for Russia, but in Canada, we've been, you know, there's a spot for it, and people have been working to make that happen. And, you know, the difference
the difference is, because we have a pretty good educational system here in Canada, and I think the difference is the scholarships, especially on the women's side. And you know, we don't offer scholarships to the people who are playing university tennis in Canada. Now, I think there's one school in the entire country now that is offering two scholarships, and you know, that works out to be about $3,000 per year. And I know at Stanford it costs about $60,000 per year. So I think that's definitely one thing. And you know, obviously it's going to be a big work in progress to create the depth in players so that they're challenged. You know, I think it would be they do have the university games, and we've sent players to that, and obviously the U.S. has sent players to that, and I think they dominate it, but obviously. But I don't know the rest of the countries in the world, you know, why they don't set up that kind of system. I mean, it's a great question.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm glad to hear that. It's being looked at up there, and it's not to take anything away. The Statue of Liberty says, bring us your tired, you're hungry. You know, that's you know, what we're looking for here are the hungry athletes that can contribute to the system and help. I mean, my position on my team was the internationals always brought a certain bit of attitude to our teams, and then the Americans contributed back to the internationals in that regard, and it was a healthy synergy.
Right.
You know, I'm gonna be curious here. And I mean, when we look at this, and we'll talk a little bit of professional tennis here, and we'll wrap up with a little bit more college tennis. But when you look at the two systems currently, I mean, we just lost the head of player development, and rightfully so. And I speak for my opinion here. We had a part-time director of player development and a part-time national international broadcaster. So it's no wonder why our professional tennis stinks. But now we're going to make some changes, and I'm excited to see this. You guys, our neighbors in the north, you're passing us by. When you look at the two systems, I mean, in your opinion, Ralph, I mean, what could or what should we be doing a little bit differently down here?
Well, that's a complicated question, and I think that we're having some success. You know, our national centers are having some success, and I think that Canada at this point is allowing for our national centers to have some success. Now, you know, we have the same dilemmas, and a lot of the coaches aren't happy about national centers, and they want to develop their own players, et cetera, and that's rightfully so. I would be the exact same way if I was working in the private sector a bit more. But, you know, tennis is very expensive, and so the federation is able to contribute in that matter. And with our weather here in Canada, much as I make my girls play outside when it's 9 degrees, the fact of the matter is we can't play outside for at least 6 months a year. Indoor court time is expensive, and it's very difficult to get 4 or 5 hours of court time per day. So the federation contributes to the travel, and I spent the winter in South America, basically Florida and South America last year, and so that's where the federation helps. What I think the U.S. needs to do is have more streams. I don't think that shutting down their national centers in California or Boca, I don't think that's the answer, because I think there's a place for them. But I also think that the USTA has to contribute more to the private sector, because the U.S. in general has better weather, and it's a lot easier for a coach to develop a player privately in the U.S. because of the weather, and they can get more court time, and there's obviously more players, so you know, you're not challenged with hitting partners, that kind of stuff. So I think that if the focus, someone could just, I'm sure there's some pretty clever guys out there who can draw a nice flow chart with one flow going to the college system and developing it that way, one flow going to the national centers, one flow going to the private sector, where the USTA, which has scads of money, can
reward the players and the coaches based on results. And, you know, the players who are deserving can go and want to can go to the national centers and get their development that way. And, you know, there's always going to be, especially in the guys' side, late bloomers who go to college and, you know, they can grow a foot while they're in college and have 150-mile-an-hour serves and be top 10 in the world. And, you know, I think they're just everybody, we'd have to be obtuse to think there's one way of doing things. And I think that there's lots of clever guys who can, like I said, make a flow chart and have about four or five different streams towards the professional level and fund it appropriately.
Yeah, man, that's valuable advice. Ralph, have you applied down here for the USTA job?
I haven't, but if anyone's listening out there, I can be bought.
All right. Well, I had one other opinionated question before I let you go today. I think personally that we deal with some of the most elite athletes in the world in regards to tennis players, professional, so on and so forth. In your opinion, we take the best American football players, basketball, baseball, volleyball, soccer, softball, other sports, track and field that are out there, and we put them in a competition, sort of a decathlon of modern sporting events, skills, not necessarily events, but skills, you know, that are associated with sports, so changes of direction, speed, quickness, you know, power, strength, all of these things. How do you think tennis does against the world's greatest athletes, Ralph?
I think it ranks pretty high. And I'm probably like you, I'm biased in that matter, but I think it ranks pretty high. And, you know, we could probably take some of the best tennis players in the world and they could have been successful at whatever sport they chose to do. I think it ranks. I don't think it is the highest, but I think tennis is probably the hardest game to master. You know, because of all the different elements, the physical elements, the mental elements, and the tactical elements, etc. And so, yeah, I'm biased with you. I think it's right up there with the hardest athletics in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Ralph, it has been, I can't believe that this has gone by as fast as it does. I had Coach Camper on last week from Louisiana Tech, very passionate about what he does. You today, my gosh, I could have talked to both you guys for a couple of days, and I think we could have filled the airways. Just outstanding, Ralph.
Well, it's been a real pleasure, and you know, I'd like to just take this opportunity to thank guys like you and thank you personally for doing what you do, because you know, you're a great voice, and your show is always interesting, and you're going to make a difference if you're already not making a difference. So,
well, I appreciate that, Ralph, and I've got you on the on my contact list. I'll look forward to getting you back on the air in the future and talk some more tennis.
Well, I'll look forward to that.
Well, thank you so much. Have a great day. Try to enjoy some outside hitting up there in Canada.
Hey, it's overcast, but I just looked at the temperature, and it's 13 degrees now, and we're going to sweat it up right about now.
Well, have a great time out there, though.
Good stuff. Thanks.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Coach Ralph Platts. Ralph is a guest from the North. Tennis Canada, they're one of their top national coaches over there. He's got a strong history of working with some great professional athletes, and you can tell that system is doing wonders right now. And you know, it's never a bad idea to, as far as I know, being a small town person, it's never a bad idea to walk across the street, to knock on your neighbor's door, and say, "Hey, how are things going? You know, I noticed that you're doing some good things over here. Can I have some influence? I mean, you've been looking at us for a while. What what do you think we could do a little bit differently here? And Ralph, a giving person here, offered up some very valuable bits of information, and excited that he shared that today. Now, the last thing that I'm gonna leave you with today is, in my opinion, one of the most exciting times of the year. This is the time of the year where the ITA, the USTA, put on their small college regional championships. And if you don't know what this is, shame on you. I understand Division I tennis. I completely get that. I think that we need the Stanfords, we need the USCs, we need the Floridas, we need the Georgias. But the rest of the world needs to know about the small colleges, because these are the heart and minds of America, and these are the people that make this thing run. The small college regional championships are the other divisions, 2, 3, NAIA, and JUCO, and California Community College is included in that. There are 61 of these small college regional championships that are going to be held between September 11th and September 29th, and these kids are passionately playing for their spot at the small college championships, which is just one of the greatest untold stories in tennis, where all of these champions get together and do battle in a realm unlike any other. And then you have a tournament within the tournament, and that is even more fun. That small college championships will be held October 9th through the 12th at Palmetto Tennis Center in Sumter, South Carolina, and I'm sure Coach Bear for that. These kids, this is where amateur tennis is at its best. And I know from my experience at the community college level, this is where interdivisional play begins. And this is where the small colleges lead by example. This is where they show the rest of the Division I world that interdivisional play is great. It needs to be happen more often, and this is the way we do it. And we crown a champion that has the hope and the dreams of going and playing with you big dogs and seeing if we can win. And I sure hope one day that we have a small college champion that comes through these waters and knocks all of these Division I players out of the water. And that he or she comes along and just flabbergasts these people, and they can't figure out why would a small college person choose the route they have instead of coming to our Division I, prestigious Division I programs. You need to remember where you came from, and that's important. And at one time in this great history of our planet, we were all small-town people. And now the cities grow, and the cities seem to think that they are more important. And it's not going to be the case in the future. It will be the small town people that let everyone know. As someone told me, you know, it's the average people that rule this world, and it's so true. It's the average sum of things that rule this world, and that's where we're working towards. So. You know, when it all gets said and done here, remember, it's the ITA Small College Regional Championships that gets the heart and the soul of tennis in America. And go out there and support them. If they're in your area, go watch some of this tennis. This is great, fabulous tennis, and they need your support. So next week, when we come back on the air, we're going to have another visit from former LSU coach Tony Minnis. Tony's going to update us on a couple of things. His television show, we may get a little information about some LSU news, and we're going to talk a lot of tennis. So feel free to check back in with us next week. And until then, you know, if it's slightly warm out there, as Ralph and his kids are doing in Canada, man, we got to catch these Canadians. Get out there and hit some tennis balls, people. Let's go. Thank you, and have a great day. Bye-bye.